This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The whole point being that, you know, it's artisan philanthropy. We want it to be handmade. We want it, those connections to be direct, and we want people to feel that, you know, that they're recognized for their donation as well as a human being who deserves to be happy and deserves to have a bike.
A generation ago, the dream of owning a bicycle was one shared by a vast number of American kids. While the explosion of competitors like video games and iPhones may have somewhat tempered that youthful enthusiasm for bikes in this country, there are still millions of children in developing nations who can only begin to imagine having their very own bicycle. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Dan Austin, is in the business of fulfilling those dreams for kids from Belgrade to Calcutta. He talks about his philanthropic nonprofit 88 Bikes, the problem his organization is trying to solve, and the unique way it puts donors directly in touch with recipients. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives to discuss ways to tackle homelessness in this country with San Francisco City Supervisor Raphael Mandelman. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the founder of 88 Bikes, Dan Austin. Dan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So what is 88 Bikes? Explain the name and what the mission of your organization is all about.
Yeah, so 88 Bikes endows bicycles to women and girls around the world, especially the survivors of human trafficking. We launched about 13 years ago in Cambodia. 88 Bikes, the name, comes from our first year. My brother and I were in Cambodia. I was doing a documentary. He's a pediatrician. And we thought we'd ride our bike across Cambodia. And at the end of the ride, give the bikes to a couple lucky kids. We found an orphanage. There were 88 kids at the orphanage. But of course, that's two happy kids, 86 not so happy kids. That's no good. Launched a fundraiser. And we got bikes for all the kids. And when the kids got their bikes at January Day in 2007, it's just this amazing scene of happiness. And we thought, wow, we stumbled on a nice niche here. We need to do this again.
And so explain some of the areas that your organization has been focusing its efforts. You mentioned human trafficking, so I imagine a lot of Southeast Asian work.
Yeah, so we're in 17 countries right now. Southeast Asia is our hub. Cambodia is still our kind of primary target country. We've worked a lot in India, Kolkata area, Bihar, Nepal. We just did a nice project in July in the Sirkat region of Nepal. We've done a little bit in Laos and Vietnam. Philippines is good. We've also worked throughout Africa and South America. And we did a small project here in the United States on the Navajo Nation a few years ago as well.
So walk us through one of these engagements in a country like India.
Yeah, so first step is, you know, connecting with a local nonprofit that's based on the ground, preferably run by locals. That works in the field of, you know, human trafficking or sometimes domestic violence, things like that. We connect with them, we vet them, and they say, okay, you know, we have this population of heroic women and girls who could use bikes. And we say, great, how many? They identify them, they send us a list, and then we schedule a trip to go over and check it out. If it looks good, we'll endow the bikes, usually 100, 200, up to 500, 500, 600. At a time. When we give the bikes, we do so in what we call the moment of happy. That's where all the girls are gathered together. They each get a bike. They also get a picture of the person who gave them the bike. Bikes are 88 bucks. They've been 88 bucks since the beginning. So if somebody wants to endow a bike to someone, they donate $88. We use that money to purchase the bike locally, local vendors. Money stays in the economy. Bikes that are common to the regions, so they blend right in. Theft is reduced that way too. It's easier to fix. So we source the bikes locally. We gather them together. The girls get the bike, and then they get the picture of the person who gave them that bike. And we take a picture of each woman or girl holding the picture of their sponsor, and then we send that back to the person who gave them the bike. So it's this nice, you know, this nice circuit of philanthropy where everyone's kind of in it together. There's no hierarchy. The donors love it. The recipients love it. And then the bikes are theirs. They can do whatever they want with them. And we find they usually keep them for years.
What are some of the most important uses that these women and children are finding for bikes? I'm sure for the kids, it's a lot of fun, but there's probably some real survival involved as well.
It can be. It depends on the situation. Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, the bike is just a lot of fun. You're dealing with folks who've been through a lot. And so you give them something that in many of these places is kind of a big ticket item, a bike. And it gives them the sense of ownership. I'm worth it. It undercuts a lot of the things they've been told, a lot of the things they've experienced in these difficult situations. And it's, you know, something they can do that's fun. You're on a bike. You're cruising down the road. You know, the past is behind you. The future is in front of you. It's great. You know, it's a lot of fun. We've all felt that feeling of, you know, the wind in your hair. You're riding your bike. So that's the fun part. But then it's also really useful. They can get to school. They can get to work. They can get across town. They can save money not having to use public transportation or whatever. Sometimes there isn't public transportation, so the bike can get them to the community center or their friends' houses. So there's that. It's super, super useful. And we find that, you know, it also can help them build businesses. We've had girls who, they were going to use the bike to start a mobile beauty salon. A bunch of girls in Laos that we gave bikes to. So there's all kinds of different applications, from being super, super fun, a sense of freedom, a sense of joy, and all the way down to just being really, really useful too.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder of 88 Bikes, Dan Austin. So Dan, let's flip it around to your U.S. operations. So you mentioned how there are individual donors who give $88, and that pays for a bike for a needy person in a developing country. What about some of the organizations you partner with and fundraise from? Maybe you can explain some of the impact they make, and maybe anybody who's listening who wants to make more of an impact or get involved in 88 Bikes, how they could get connected.
Cool. Yeah. Well, the vast majority of our donors are individuals. We have several thousand folks who've given one bike, two bikes, 10 bikes, whatever. We have donors who donated the first year back in end of 2006, early 2007, and they still donate every year. So our model is based on individual donors. We have a sustaining membership campaign called Ride Forever, where we ask $8 a month. That's it. And we've got a bunch of folks who've signed up for that as well, that helps us greenlight projects in difficult to reach regions or more expensive regions. We're really grassroots. You know, we want it to be about the people. We want to answer to all of these small stakeholders in what we do, whether they're donating $8 a month or they donate a bike every once in a while. And it tends to work. And we really like the one-to-one connection. So it works for the donor, but again, it works for the recipient too. When we followed up with these women and girls, years and years later, often they have their bikes, and often they have the card, the donor card we gave them from so-and-so in Los Angeles or San Francisco, who gave them that bike. They keep those cards. They're like talismans to them. It elevates the gift, and it makes them feel like it didn't just fall out of the sky, but it was something that was given to them by somebody who cared. And we find that's just about as important as anything. When we give the recipient a bike, we always ask her what she wants to be when she grows up, or what's her big dream for her life. And we've heard everything from break dancer to doctor to teacher. Teacher's the number one profession, by the way, we've heard across the world. It's really inspiring. And then on the back of the card, we flip it over, there's a world map, so we can show where she lives in the world and where her donor lives. And they love that as well. After the bike endows, we send a card back in the mail to the donors, so they get something in their mailbox, a nice little card that they can put on their fridge or bring to their office or whatever. And the donors love that too. The whole point being that, you know, it's artisan philanthropy. We want it to be handmade. We want those connections to be direct, and we want people to feel that, you know, that they're recognized for their donation, as well as a human being who deserves to be happy and deserves to have a bike.
They asked if I believe, and do the angels really grieve, or is it all a comforting invention? It's like gravity, I said, it's not a product of my head. It doesn't speak, but nonetheless commands attention. I don't care what it means, who decorates the scenes. The problem is more with a sense of pride. keeps me thinking me instead of what it is to be. I'm not a passenger, I am the ride. I'm not a passenger, I am the ride.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder of 88 Bikes, Dan Austin. So we've done a lot of pieces on Sea Change Radio about bike sharing and bike programs in cities around the globe. Have you had discussions with governments and non-governmental organizations and corporations about expanding the program, or do you want it to be kind of based on that one-to-one model? Like, what would happen if, let's say, a Citibank, who I know was doing a big bike sharing program that was not a profitable business for them. It was not. It was a lost leader. They were allowed to advertise in Bordeaux, France. This was kind of, I think, 10 years ago, to start a bike sharing program with their name on it. Let's say that they wanted to go in, work with 88 Bikes in Delhi. Would that be something that 88 Bikes would be able to foster, or are you strictly in the one-to-one model?
It's possible. You know, we did a very small bike share in Nepal on this last trip. You know, we found that a lot of the recipients could use a bike and they needed it, so we gave them bikes. And then we did about 10 bikes with this NGO in Nepal where you know, anyone could use the bikes. And so it was a little bit of a riff on the model. And I'm committed to this one-to-one model because I think that part of it is the efficacy of a bike and everything. But part of it's just this feeling of self-worth that comes when you're given something joyful and fun and valuable. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, there's different applications for different areas. And we'd be up for anything. I love bike shares. Yeah, bike shares have done amazing things for cities.
So maybe you can give an example or two of 88 Bikes in action, Dan.
Sure. One of my favorite stories comes from Serbia. We gave a bunch of bikes to women and girls, most of whom had been trafficked. They'd gone through terrible conditions and just a horrible ordeal. One girl we gave a bike to, her name was Seika, and she told our partners later that after getting the bike, this was the first time that she'd felt respected and beautiful again. We didn't ask her about her past. We said, you want to walk through the streets of Belgrade and we'll do a little photo shoot with you and your bike. She was delighted to be seen as something, to not be defined by what had happened to her, but be able to look forward. The other story I also love, another one from Serbia, actually. We gave a bike to a 16-year-old girl named Elma who had just married her boyfriend. Her family had wanted her to marry this older guy. She said, no, she lopes with her boyfriend. That's great and all, but how are they going to support themselves? The family's disowned them. She starts renting out this bike to friends in her community. And she makes enough money renting the bike out that she buys another bike and then another bike. Her husband is a mechanic. Flash forward a couple years, she's got dozens of bikes now and she has her own little bike share program outside of Belgrade in Serbia. So she leveraged the gift of one bike and turned it into a career that she is now using to support her family. I love those stories.
That's really cool. So you mentioned how the vast majority of your donations are one-to-one. But the 88 bike staff needs to make money as well and pull a salary. Do you then get corporate donors or grants? How does your nonprofit function in terms of your own operations?
We've gotten some corporate support, and we're very grateful to that. The folks corporate-wise that have helped us out have done so without any strings. They wanted to support either bikes or some of our other programs. These aren't huge grants. They're nice, modest grants, medium-sized grants, and we're very grateful to them for that. We also, like I mentioned, are able to kind of support the very low admin expenses we have, by the way. We don't have an office. We've never paid for office space, and everyone is at least a part-time volunteer. So we supplement a lot of our costs though with this monthly subscriber campaign. You know, $8 a month is what we ask, and we have nice little giveaways too. Mirror, a wonderful company up in Seattle that makes cool mugs and things. They gave us a bunch of great mugs. We got a designer involved who did an image and a design on the mug, and we're giving those away to the folks who sign up for the Ride Forever campaign. That's $8 a month. That's a chai latte and a croissant at your favorite coffee shop in the morning. It's not much. But cumulatively, all of those donations come together to help us out. And we found that as much as possible, we want to rely upon individuals, small donations. We're grateful for the big ones, of course. That's terrific. But you know, we love the fact that for the most part, were driven by small donations.
It would seem like kids in the U.S. who have no real problem getting a bike. There's free bikes. If you look on Nextdoor or Craigslist, there's a lot of kids who probably take for granted the availability of something like a bike. Do you have any school programs where kids are kind of pooling their funds and having a direct connection in the U.S. with kids overseas?
Yeah, we have a lot of lemonade stands, school groups, church groups, whatever you name it, of folks who've come together to pool their money to do fundraisers to help out these women and girls across the world, and they all get the donor card back in the mail and feel that connection, and we found that when they followed up a year or two later, it's been a really powerful thing for the kids involved. We love those groups. And by the way, on the refugee angle, we're looking at doing a project soon with Syrian refugee women and girls in Greece. We want to affect that population too, and do what we can to help out across the world wherever bikes can help someone move forward a little bit.
Dan Austin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's been fun. Thanks.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by San Francisco Supervisor Rafael Mandelman. He represents District 8. Rafael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to have you on not to talk about San Francisco politics, because it's a very tangled web and most of the country doesn't want to even begin to follow the inner workings of it. But you're intimately familiar with the issue of homelessness, and it's a important issue all over the country. And why don't you first talk about your background and why you have a unique perspective on the homeless issue?
Yeah. I actually think more families have folks who have had experiences with mental illness and or homelessness than you would know. But when I was 11 years old, my mother, who probably had been struggling with mental health issues for much of her life, got significantly worse, and she was not able to take care of me after that point. And I ended up moving up to San Francisco and living with my grandmother initially, and then other families that sort of took me in and let me live with them in informal foster care. But my mother's life, continued to sort of spiral out, and she actually ended up in a homeless shelter for a period when I was, I think, a freshman in college. And I remember being, I was privileged to be in some really great academic institutions, and I was an undergrad at Yale at the time, and I was calling my mother from this ornate, amazing library where I was studying, and she was in a shelter. So when I was older, I got a conservatorship over her and eventually moved her up to San Francisco. But I do think that, there are this is not the entire homeless problem, but there are a chunk of our homeless population who are folks who are just sick, and we leave them out on our streets. And I think particularly in California, we leave a lot of mentally ill and drug addicted folks out there who we should not be leaving out there.
Yes, and maybe you can give a brief history of the way San Francisco and its political class has tried to handle the issue. San Francisco wasn't one of the richest cities in the country in 1980, but maybe you can go back to that period during the Reagan era. And how did San Francisco tackle its growing homeless population? And then maybe kind of get us up to date if you can.
So different mayoral administrations have each struggled with this problem and have had a different set of responses. And one of the frustrating things about homeless policy is that it can shift pretty dramatically depending on what the mayoral administration is. But Art Agnos was the first mayor who was really, I think called upon to deal with this problem. While he was mayor, I was in high school, but at the time. But basically, our civic center was taken over by a giant homeless encampment, and this went on for months and months and months. And Agnos, as a good liberal, was reluctant to clear the place, but it was symptomatic of a growing problem that he got blamed for. And ultimately, he did clear Civic Center and started implementing a set of responses. But he was, you know, blamed for problems that were not really of his creation. And he was voted out after one term, largely on people's frustration with the homelessness crisis. And then he was succeeded by Frank Jordan, who came in and had a different approach.
He was like the former police chief.
He was former police chief, and he had, at least rhetorically, his response was that we needed a more of a criminal justice response, or that, you know, we needed to clear the streets and have police officers going out with social workers. He called it Matrix. And, you know, so that was his policy for his one term as mayor.
And that was quite controversial.
And it was very controversial at the time. And then Willie Brown came in. And Willie Brown was, you know, politically a very successful mayor, but certainly de-emphasized dealing with homelessness, at least as a matter of something he was going to talk about. We built out a significant programs for homeless folks while he was mayor. But I think he saw what had happened to Agnos and Jordan and was not going to make this, you know, the centerpiece of what he was going to be talking about. And so San Franciscans, I think, became again increasingly frustrated with the crisis. And Gavin Newsom, who was on the Board of Supervisors during Brown's administration, kind of tapped into that frustration around the ongoing homelessness crisis and made that the centerpiece of his campaign for mayor. And he pursued a policy called Care Not Cash, which felt like, to some, very punitive. I didn't support it at the time. It was basically eliminating the cash grant that homeless folks were receiving. But to Newsom's credit, he did significantly invest in new supportive housing for homeless folks, and they moved thousands of homeless people off the streets. But even that relatively significant investment was not enough to solve a problem that is fundamentally, you know, national in scope.
So catch us up on where things are today in San Francisco regarding homelessness, and what templates you and your colleagues will look towards when you're trying to see what works. Yeah.
Well, I think the perception of most housed San Franciscans is that homelessness is worse than it has ever been before. And it's interesting because objectively the numbers have not increased in San Francisco all that much. The last homeless count, I think, showed something between 7,000 and 8,000 homeless people on the streets. That's sort of within the range of where it's been probably for 5 or 10 years. So there and at the same time, actually, regionally, the homeless population has gone up significantly. So in some ways, we're doing better than some of our neighbors in the region. But I think what people are reacting to is that the homeless population we have is older and sicker, more mentally ill folks, and more folks using a lot of really hard drugs, whether it's meth or opioids. You know, there's a growing phenomenon of needles all over and people going downtown and seeing folks shooting up. And I think there is a sense from, again, housed people in particular, that the level of public disorder has grown significantly. And so the challenge for elected officials is then to craft, you know, a response that meets the need of their constituents for public spaces they can use, but is also compassionate and humane and actually addresses the real problems of homeless people. And the responses have been pretty divergent, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine one person who spends $3 million on their slick new home and then has somebody pooping on their front yard or has needles there.
Right.
They have more of a voice in the political process, whether we like it or not, than that mentally ill person.
Right.
But we have to have compassion for both of these individuals.
Right. And, you know, even if you don't have a $3 million home, you get pretty annoyed if you walk out your door and there's human poop there, which is, also a growing phenomenon. So what we have right now going on in the city is pretty aggressive sweeps of homeless encampments by the current interim mayor. And that does, seemingly on at least a temporary basis, is directly addressing the concerns that people have been expressing about what's happening in their neighborhoods. I'm unconvinced that over time it's going to be sustainable and that it isn't just going to end up moving these folks around from sort of neighborhood to neighborhood. And that has been the experience of prior sweeps.
Yeah, well, break down the sweeps. What do they entail and what is a navigation center, for example?
The navigation centers are a response to this growing homeless population on the streets. I mentioned Gavin Newsom's housing policy, which was very focused on creating supportive housing, sort of more permanent housing options for people who are homeless. Newsom actually really did not believe in shelters. In his view, if you had a dollar to spend, you should spend that on permanent housing, not on shelter. And so, and that's a reasonable view. And so during his administration, we reduced the number of shelter beds we had in the city, significantly increased what we were spending on supportive housing. And that largely continued through the Lee administration, which succeeded Newsom. But of course, during that time, the street population is growing. The concerns of housed people are getting more acute about what's happening with the street population. And so the Board of Supervisors really pushed the idea that we needed to have some kind of reinvestment in shelter. And the navigation centers are supposed to be a really easy access point for folks to come out and off the streets. They may not have the same rules as more traditional shelters. You may be able to bring in your girlfriend or your boyfriend, your dog, your stuff. They really are supposed to be an enticement to get folks who might not otherwise engage with the system to get in off the streets, and particularly in areas that are experiencing the growth of these tent encampments, which we've seen over the last several years as well. Relatively new phenomena is not just homeless folks, but homeless folks living in groupings of 10 or 20 or 30 with tents. Interesting that it took until the last few years for this to emerge, but it's taken on kind of a life of its own in San Francisco over that period. And so you have very large encampments. Now, this is, again, a statewide phenomena. Orange County just cleared, I think, a 2-mile-long encampment that had hundreds of tents.
I saw a video of it. It was incredible how long it went for. Yeah. And you can understand if you were a homeless single mother, you would want some kind of community. There is strength in numbers, even Absolutely. In a homeless population, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I spend a lot of time actually talking to homeless people on the street because I'm out campaigning, and of course, homeless people are interested in politics too, and so they come up and engage me in conversations. And their perspectives are very different on some issues from, most housed people. You know, this homeless guy I was speaking to in the last week, was telling me, you politicians think that tents are the problem. Tents are the solution. Tents, give us a place to be where we're not going to get rained on and keep us out of the way and keep us safe. And I hear that. I think it's untenable to have large tent encampments in urbanized areas. I just don't think the housed people are going to tolerate that.
Rafael Mandelman, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Herbie Hancock and Chris Smither.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.